All statements, views, and opinions are personal and do not represent the United States government, the Department of War, or the United States Army. Welcome to the Insights from the Fight podcast, the show dedicated to bringing you lessons learned from exercises, operations, and Army fielded forces. I'm your host, Mr. Jeremy Sturmer. On episode 4, I spoke with leadership from 112 Infantry Battalion about their experience as part of Joint Task Force Southern Border. In January of 2026, CAWL published the Initial Impressions Report, Securing the Border. CAWL is currently working with 10th Mountain to publish a collection of lessons, reflections, and observations they've assembled from their time on the border. Joining us today are Lieutenant Colonels Aaron Childers and Chad Corbin, who served as the G3 and G2 of Joint Task Force Southern Border as members of 10th Mountain Division. Thank you both for being here today. Before we begin, can you introduce yourselves to our audience and provide a brief overview of your history and background leading to that assignment?
Sure, thanks, Jeremy. My name is Aaron Childers. I'm an infantry officer. I served in light and mechanized units. Been on both the joint staff and the Army staff. Commanded 230 Infantry and 3rd Brigade 10th Mountain Division at Fort Polk, Louisiana. And then I moved up to Fort Drum to serve as the G3 for 10th Mountain. I was the J3 for JTF Southern Border from February to May. In May, I came here to Fort Leavenworth as part of the George C. Marshall Fellowship Program. It's a war college program under the School of Advanced Military Studies. Happily married to my wife, Christine. We've got 4 kids and love it here at Fort Leavenworth.
Hey, thanks for having us. I'm Chad Corbin, currently at Mission Command Training Program for Ops Group Alpha, so I'm the Corps in ASCC, or Field Army Intel OCT, formerly the 10th Mountain G2, which is why I'm here as the first JTF Southern Border J2. My career has consisted of tactical intelligence support to the infantry division below and the Joint Special Operations Command, so I've been a 2 at every echelon from division down to battalion. And then my wife, Carolyn, and my 2 kiddos, Luis and Ainsley, have been along with me to make this thing happen. Excited to be here, excited to talk about our experience on the border.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. 2025 marked the 101st year of the United States Border Patrol securing the international border and was also the first time a joint task force would be established to gain full operational control of the dividing line between the U.S. and Mexico border. In February of 2025, 10th Mountain Division received official notice to deploy and establish the Corps of JTF Southern Border assigned to U.S. NORTHCOM while integrating with the U.S. Border Patrol. Within a matter of days, boots were on the ground at Fort Huachuca, setting up a headquarters to coordinate efforts along a vast border stretching 1,954 miles from San Diego, California to the Gulf of Mexico. Let's initially talk from your initial notification and receiving orders to serve as a JTF. What was the key guidance that was given to the staff to begin planning and defining the problems as part of your mission analysis?
Well, thanks, Jeremy. So there are a couple of things that were involved with this. We wanted to understand the operational environment down there on the border. So this was a no-notice deployment, or we were actually getting ready to move into a warfighter that was going to start on Sunday. And then on Thursday, we learned that we were going to go down to the border. So the 3 planning efforts that went into this, we conducted MDMP to create a movement order. And we moved through design to understand the problem set down there at the border. And then we went into MDMP again to reset the forces on the border. So that timeline, again, last week of January, we received the word that we were going to deploy. Immediately, we sent 2-person teams, usually a major and a sergeant major, down to the border to try and find what actual infrastructure was down there. Colonel Rich Satterlin, our division chief, led us through the planning process. So that first week of February, really we had to organize the division to start to deploy. So at Fort Drum, that meant we had 1 brigade going out the door to OIR. At the same time, we were starting to deploy the division headquarters. So everyone, you know, got as much packed, as much as they could, got our expeditionary equipment together. And at that point, we started to receive the feedback from these teams that said Fort Huachuca was the best place to house JTF. We started to push units out, and the staff moved on to the design process to understand the problem set. So looking at the history of the southern border, looking at the mission set that was involved, we knew that our forces would increase exponentially from what was currently there on the border. And then in mid-February, the majority of the division staff started to arrive at Fort Huachuca. So we were on the ground, set up the infrastructure involved with the JOC Joint Operations Center, the additional locations that ended up being Fort Sam Houston, Fort Bliss, Marine Corps Air Station, they all started to receive PACs as well. And we started MDMP again to reorganize the southern border into different areas and flow at that point almost 8,000 people down and move them across the border in about 2 weeks to include their equipment. And then from there, in March, we published another order to the JTF to begin sustained operations and publish a campaign plan to continue operations really into the steady state that they're in now.
Yeah, so Aaron did a great job of laying all that out. Just from an intel perspective, operating inside the continental United States can create well-intended intel oversight. I went to my team and I said, hey, we've got to do a detailed analysis of all the intel oversight regulations that dictate how we share information with potentially the Mexican military, the interagency partners, law enforcement. How do we do all these things? Because as a Title 10 active duty intel soldier, it's very clear regulatory guidance which you can and can't do in support of law enforcement. So that was my first concern. And I got the team kind of rowing on that so that we could provide just understanding to the staff. And to properly advise the commander, we had to make sure we knew exactly what was required through intel oversight. The second was intel focused at echelon. I was on the border in 2019 with 3rd Brigade of the 101st, took over for 3rd Brigade of the 10th Mountain Division. And so I wanted to use my personal experience to advise the chief of staff on, and Aaron, on the things that we're going to have to ask our North Force. How do we ask for authorities that might not commonly be associated with the border mission? And so there was a paradigm that you had to take a look at. What had been done in the past, what the executive order was telling us we were going to do, and what we were going to have to do to get after certain sets of authorities. And so using my personal experience, and then looking at the fight at echelon, NORTHCOM has a mission, our North has a mission, JTF North has a mission, the country team, U.S. Embassy Mexico City has a mission. Where does JTF's southern border fit in that from an intel perspective? It was a question that took months to answer, frankly. And then with these intel oversight conditions, what we might look at for the intel focus, how is that gonna drive the operations process once we get the theater set, once we reorganize the joint operations area? How do we drive the operations process, and then how do we inform the boss, General Nauman, as he's making decisions in these conversations with multiple interagency partners, just not Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection, which were our primary partners, but the whole of government.
How did you take guidance from above, get it to your commander, and then begin to process that as a staff so that he could do those vision things, and how you establish relationships to be able to start gathering the information and understanding your roles and responsibilities with those partners?
So when it comes to intent, the commander's vision, and essential tasks, this was really kind of a unique mission set because a lot of this came down directly from the White House. So when President Trump took office, he signed Executive Order 14165 and 14167. And in that, he used the terminology of sealing the U.S. southern border. And that was a direct task to U.S. NORTHCOM. So we coordinated with Army North, but the JTF itself was a direct report to U.S. NORTHCOM. So Major General Scott Nauman, who was the division commander of 10th Mountain, spent a lot of time trying to make sure we got the terminology correct from the strategic level all the way down to, you know, the division being the highest tactical level. And the term SEAL isn't really a tactical task. So one of the things that the staff worked with, and then our DCGO, Brigadier General Joe Escandone, also helped us craft what was strategic level intent into tactical level tasks. So that when a op order is issued down to the lowest level, that soldier, that Marine, understands what we're asking of them. And what we got out of that was the tactical task of control. And the reason we use control, it's a tactical task, you know, which means a unit maintains physical influence over an assigned area. By controlling an area, units prevent an enemy force from using it to create conditions necessary for friendly operations. When you look at that definition, that aligns to what we were trying to do with the border. It wasn't one striker every 100 meters. It was key areas able to prevent the enemy, or in this case, cartels, from using the border and thereby accomplishing the president's intent. So there was a large part of how do I take strategic guidance and how do I take it all the way down to the tactical level. Now, the other thing, that this isn't a new mission. Right, and I think it's lost on a lot of people that, you know, the Army has had a presence at the border really since like the 1830s and 40s. There was the Mexican Expedition in 1916, again after World War I. And then since the 1970s, there's been a pretty sustained presence of the U.S. military, even the active military, down on the border. Chad mentioned it started with 310, went to 101, then there were three Compo 1 and 2 units down, really 2018. When we went to the border, the 90th Sustainment Brigade was already there. They started under the previous administration. And what we looked at is how do we get, you know, what's already existing and realign that to have three landowning brigades, a Division Sustainment Brigade, Combat Aviation Brigade minus, all on the border. And, oh, by the way, how are we going to accomplish what DHS asked for us in their request for forces? So all that we took from the different intents, molded it into a military order, and then issued that out in a way that every soldier and Marine could execute. And also, 1st Marine Division Blue Diamond was also on the border with their sappers and throughout the entire mission.
As you're looking at this mission, how do you help the commander understand the environment, physical as well as the people that are there, based on the relationships that you had in this planning phase?
Yeah. So unfortunately, of all the people in my G2 shop, I was the only one that had any knowledge of cartels, right? Like, everybody else had a vast knowledge of Russian, Chinese, military, Islamic extremists, right? I was the only one that had looked at this before. And that puts us at risk because the senior fusion techs are now trying to learn stuff, right? The intel sergeants, who end up being the most critical part of this machine, have to learn a new target set. And so preface that with saying, what a great chance to share 20 years of counterinsurgency, counterterrorism experience with junior soldiers and NCOs who aren't really being taught those skills at the schoolhouse anymore, which is fine because we're tooled for large-scale combat operations now. I've got to get Chief CW3 Abe Pence online with what the cartels are, right? But what is really important to this is something that Aaron talked about. Is so SEAL is the verbiage used in the executive order. We landed on a control during mission analysis. And so what affects the control of the border? You know, with an A, not an E. So that intel echelon is what we eventually came to. The things that daily come to the border and cross it, either people or narcotics, in between the points of entry, those are the things we worry about. And so once we really drilled down on that threat to control of the border, we were able to start getting the intel machine rolling on a knowledge. Because at the beginning, it just started with the first mission analysis brief was like, there are 13 cartels that influence the border. There are this Sinaloa cartel, Jalisco Nuevo Generation. These are the big players, sir. But you know, we don't have finite detail, mostly because the people that were looking at the mission were looking at cartel leaders. And so in Customs and Border Protection Office of Intelligence, we're looking at an echelon down. Who are the people that are coming across the border that affect the border, but in a different way? You know, major narcotics dealing, massing at the ports of entry of narcotics and human beings. Who brings across migrants that are not South American or Mexican, but Chinese, other countries of interest. And so control as the idea for what we're going in gives us the intel leverage to get to it. And so the first bunch of MA briefs, or IPO briefs, really weren't any more than kind of a high school report on cartels and the criminal networks that affect control of the border. Once we got on the border, we were able to start really driving down and giving a clear picture of like, these are the individuals that we want to focus on, and here's why, and being able to give the boss clarity. And that in giving, honestly, the voice to the intel folks in what becomes JTF Southern Border, a way to communicate with the players. There are more players than you can list on a single sheet of paper on the Southern Border. And it was, how do I build a network of intel professionals along the border that go from law enforcement, which we're doing awareness with them, the intel community, the big ones, you know, National Security Agency, etc. How do I build a network of those people and not get inside of the equity cycle that they already have and communicate what JTF Southern Border is trying to do? And so I determine that as my essential task. I give the boss the ability through that network, understanding what affects the control of the border daily, we're able to communicate so that he can understand and visualize. So I would give us a C+ on our first bunch of IPO products But once we got down there and started having conversations with people like Chris McDonald at the Southern Border Intel Center, Custom Border Protection Office of Intelligence, started having conversations with the regional intel cell leaders out there, one of which I previously served with in JSOC, which was a great benefit. I was able to pick up the phone and say, hey, Mike, can you tell me more about what's going on in your sector? That is how we were getting after helping Mountain Six understand and visualize. Because, you know, in this chain of questioning, we're still pretty early. We're talking 3 weeks in. We're just trying to write some high school reports on cartels. We weren't into the graduate level of persona targeting, which we eventually get to.
Right. The other thing we had the opportunity to do, because we were increasing the number of people at the border, is we got this opportunity to look at the border holistically. We really got a chance to look in at what's the best way to accomplish the mission. So, for example, the military borders didn't match the FEMA borders, didn't match the border patrol sectors, customs and border protection sectors. So when we sat down and moved through design, we got the opportunity to say, well, this doesn't make any sense. And so let's have our borders match our partners with CBP. And that way, when we move through COA development and start to array forces, you have the opportunity to say companies are down at these different headquarters, and each sector gets a battalion staff with it, and they report to a brigade commander, which then reports to a division commander. Mm-hmm. And this did a couple of things. So number one, it put a battalion staff with the CBP headquarters. So you had a commander to talk operations with the sector commander. You had an intel officer to work information that came in from CBP. You had an S4 to talk about supplies, and they had their own maintenance concerns as well. But it also did things that were just inherently practiced at in the military, like cross-border coordination. Hey, we have this element moving from this border patrol sector to this border patrol sector. Let me pick up the phone and call my adjacent unit. Things that sound relatively simple to all of us when we're doing operations, because it's part of our makeup, it's part of our DNA as soldiers, but weren't necessarily there from the law enforcement side. And CBP is extremely capable at the tactical level, you know, tracking, things like that. But it puts this structure in place that wasn't there before, especially when you start integrating ops and intel. Now I've got forces that are arrayed across the border. I've got a targeting process that will move and allocate different assets to answer PIRs to get after what is ultimately the President of the United States' intent. And that's the power. Like, you talk about what is a division headquarters good use for, where we're really good at tracking units, you know, hunting systems and hunting people. And when you put that down and you operationalize that across the border, that's the power that really comes from doing that.
One of the things that we normally talk about with JTF is building the right team. How much did you have the ability to build the team prior to getting down there? And then how much were you able to adjust that once you started to realize the differences between maybe what you thought the mission was going to be at the very beginning and what it became as you went through it?
I think I had the most friction. And it's just because it's like I foreshadowed with the intel fight at Echelon. The Northcom J2 had a request for forces in that was separate from Northcom's request for division headquarters. And so they had it in their mind that they were going to build Joint Intelligence Task Force on the border. It's kind of headquartered out of the Southern Border Intel Center in Tucson at Customs Border Protection Office of Intelligence. And then there was a request for support from DHS, from O&I Office of Intelligence, for soldiers to support them. So right off the bat, you had three competing requests to the Joint Staff for Department of War, you know, capability and capacity. And so as a Division G2, you go and look at the JPs and you look at what a J2 looks like, and you see joint, you know, Marines that are really good at HUMIT with some of those guys. Air Force is better at SIGINT than we are, like the Interagency Intelligence Community Coordination Cell. So we put that on our chart and it went up and it was immediately cut because there was so many requests for forces and support all the way up to the Joint Staff already. And so that leads us back to, well, if we're not going to get an agency rep, or we're not going to get a DIA rep, or we're not going to get an NGA rep inside of the JTF headquarters, and they're all going to go to Southern Border Intel Center, and that's fine because that's where the lion's share of the work is being done now, how do we tap into that, right? So you dust off the publication, you look at what the 101 did with OIR. We looked at that as a case study. Unconstrained, we thought we had the best solution. Not known to us is these other RFFs and RFCs are going up through the pipeline, that immediately becomes a constraint to your internal planning. And it becomes a network building thing versus who do you need on, like, from the interagency, not who do you need from the joint force. Because that part is kind of easy. You just look at what the strengths of the services are for intelligence disciplines. You make a few phone calls. The NORTHCOM J2 at the time was Brigadier General Calabrese. So in conversations with him, hey, sir, what do you think? You know, from an Air Force perspective, who do you think should be bolted on my staff? We ended up getting a Marine, one star, and we still weren't done with the quest for the joint, the JTF yet. So it's, you know, General Winters from a Marine Corps perspective, who you think? And so we sorted it out that way. But right from the get-go, we were extremely constrained on interagency and intelligence community coordinated cells. So that becomes like a senior intel officer responsibility. It becomes a directorate responsibility inside the J2. So the human guy has to plug into CIA and DIA and make sure the equities are represented there. We ended up with Air Force 15 from OSI to be our lead for CI and human, which was great. Not something we accounted for. That was something the Air Force came to us before we even sent the request up and said, hey, we know that force protection is going to be an issue for you guys. Here's an extremely experienced CI agent he was in active theater of conflict, and they pulled him out and sent him to the border. That's how important it was to the Air Force to have the right person there. So
there are a couple of things. You know, there's doctrine for building a JTF. There's a joint pub on it. So JTFs are purpose-built. So as Chad has mentioned, you know, Brigadier General Jeremy Winters came from the Marine Corps. The Marines were one of the first to provide personnel for this. The Border Patrol also offered their equivalent to a one-star that became a deputy commander. TRANSCOM sent down the Joint Enabling Capabilities Command, which are a set of joint officers which help. When you start a JTF, there's a very prescribed process that you move through, and one of them is building the JMD, or the Joint Manning Document. Now, the Joint Manning Document is sometimes a negotiation with what other services can provide. The Army provided the core, C-O-R-E, core of that, which was a division staff on a rotational basis. So that gave us the starting point. But I think the other piece that was critical to this is our chain of command really wanted to open this up. It's the field of dreams idea that if you build it, they will come. And if you come to an ONI, you're going to be able to sit in it and hear what's going on. So what that did was open the aperture. So the JTF included folks from the Coast Guard, included folks from all facets of DHS. And it was a place where if you had a stake on the southern border, interagency reps as well, you could come and be a part of this, and made a space for you on the JOC floor. To be able to make sure we were including everything that went on the southern border. And one of the other things Chad mentioned is the RFF process. We were very cognizant of the units that we were requesting for the southern border. For 10th Mountain to go down, it was very much what's already within a division. Again, three landowning brigades, a DSB, a CAB minus. Sounds a lot like a division. What we didn't want to do were request things that were outside what a division normally has to operate with, or things that would not necessarily contribute to the border. So we wanted to have the Goldilocks piece of just the right amount of forces to be able to make the process work. And there was the urgency of we really wanted to fix the problem. I think it's important for people who are out there to understand that the cartel threats are real, that the terrain along the southern border is some of the most austere in the nation. So when there are questions like, why do you need an aerial medevac company? Well, because some of these soldiers are literally an hour and a half flight away from the nearest hospital. So all of this goes into the staff process of, as we analyze this, these are the minimum amount of forces we would need to accomplish the mission.
It also exposed some interesting things, I think, from a learning perspective. Our general support, MICO, at the 10th Mountain Division, while a division asset, Comrel, old forces command before it became Western Hemisphere Command, allocated to the division, we had to RFF for the general support, MICO, to come to the border with us. And it's something that, like, in MDMP, we kind of overlooked. You put that down in your lesson learned book, make sure you request the things that are yours, that are division assets, because in the global force management process, they don't come with you unless you request them, or they're part of the requirement the theater has laid out. And so the requirement was for a division headquarters. From our perspective, that included the Engineer Battalion, and the GS MICO. We had the RFF for both of those forces. So just a salient learning point for me. I remember the day it dawned on me, we didn't even have desks yet, and there were just cables dangling from the ceiling inside of the Mountain Thunder Activity Center, which is where I did my captain's career course social when I was at the career course at Fort Huachuca. Aaron and I are running ops out of this thing. I'm like, holy, I forgot to put an RFF in Forces Command for the GS MICO. And so we called General Calabresi, and he's a great teammate, and walked it into the G35 up at, you know, North Common, and got into the pipeline pretty quickly. But it's just something that you forget about because it snowed 3 feet the day we deployed to the border up at Drum. We got off the airplane, it was like 70 degrees at Fort Huachuca, and we thought the GS MICO was right behind us because that's part of the division, but it didn't come with us.
So as we start moving toward your execution of the mission, it was a complex mission, a large area of operations, multiple partners such as Department of War, Border Patrol, federal, state, local, tribal forces, Mexican military have used drastically different, not just in scope, but in function, probably from other requests for assistance that have gone on at the border. Certainly different than what 10th Mountain has been asked to do before. How did you go about integrating and coordinating with all of those partners to conduct operations and align resources to accomplish the mission?
And so for us, we had actually moved through a warfighter progression up to this point. So by the time we deployed down to the border, we had done 4 CPXs. We had done an MDO live fire on Fort Drum. We were over the top of a brigade as they went through JRTC, and we had done a warfighter with 1AD. When you look at systems and processes, we were actually able to adapt the things you would do in normal operations to the border itself. So for that battle rhythm, we had a 2-week cycle where you would request processes 2 weeks out, and that's where we would generate ops and intel would help generate maneuvers. So for example, Monday we had an ONI in the morning, and then we'd go to an ops sync that afternoon where the different brigades would nominate operations. Tuesday was a CUB with the commander, and then we go into the target nomination board and we do an ISR sync with all the brigade threes, the brigade twos between Chad and I. Wednesday was another ONI, and we had a refinement op sync. Thursday was a CUB, and we moved into a target decision board. Chad and I would go to, and either the commander or a DCG would go to. Friday was another ONI followed by another op sync where we lock in the assets 2 weeks out. And then Saturday we had an assessments CUB to the commander. So we managed both a long-term and a short-term calendar. We looked about 6 months out to plan operations, because what we found was when you looked at the smuggling operations, it was very seasonal. There were trends where you'd have to surge, where we'd have to request assets pretty far in advance. And being able to do what you would normally do if you were deployed, if you were going through a warfighter, but extend that out to something that's a little more sustainable was actually really, really beneficial. The other thing I'd say is when you talk about the staff-to-staff involvement, the Border Patrol was key at every piece of this to make sure we were helping them accomplish their mission. Within the staff, I mean, between the G2 and G3, the collection manager briefed at every op sync. They said in every single one of those, there was a G2 rep at almost every meeting that I as the three had. And then with the four, Lieutenant Colonel Ollie Davis, he and I discussed things multiple times a day. Really, when you talk about the requirement that they had to put people on the border that had never been on the border before, the Army started to decline this infrastructure on the border in the 1930s. And this was the first time since about the 1920s that we'd put that many people on the border. So when you talk about basing meetings, I would sit in those personally just to make sure things from the four side and the three side were actually synced up. And then lastly, with NORTHCOM, now Colonel Remy Uranowitz, we sent up to NORTHCOM, and he was integral to make sure that we were accomplishing the U.S. NORTHCOM commander's intent on a daily basis. And he was that key link between what was our higher headquarters as a four-star headquarters and us at the two-star level.
Yeah, Aaron, you know, hit the warfighter progression. We'd done a lot of training, and he talked about the formal systems and processes. The only thing to build off of that is the informal. When you do a warfighter with 1st Armored Division and 3rd Armored Corps is your higher headquarters, and you're in enhanced response cell, and you have to pick up the phone and call Iron 2. You have to talk to Phantom Warrior 2 informally outside of battle rhythm events. And so the same applies to this. Figure out who in the Border Patrol will help you understand the environment, because they have a deep knowledge that you can never get to. These guys start out as young law enforcement professionals on horseback, tracking migrants as they come across the border, and then now they're in these senior staff positions and they can tell you everything about the AO. So knowing when to pick up a phone and call them, knowing who in the interagency, whether they be forward on the border in some capacity or back in DC, no different than what you would do in large scale combat operations. So the basics of having a structured formal process to go through, structured formal LNOs, the informal communication is also extremely important. You learn that in a regular training progression and you execute it in a JTF probably more.
Okay. One other thing on that, you know, our division, Sergeant Major Johnson, spent a lot of time with the different units. So I think it's interesting when you talk about some of the things we were used to maybe 10 or 15 years ago that are sometimes lost. So Sergeant Major Johnson's up with a Lakota unit, and his question is, hey, do you have the G2's list of IRs? Do you have the NAIs that of what our ISR assets are looking at versus what you're looking at? And then you compound on top of that, hey, this is what the Border Patrol kind of knowledge of the area is. Well, if you're not used to doing that continuously in operations, it's kind of lost on, you know, folks that are unpracticed of, hey, these are the systems you have to have work. So you take our military systems, you combine it with the law enforcement expertise, and that's actually what works. But as we found is, you know, our units are deploying less and less. Some of that knowledge isn't there anymore. You know, that's a requirement for commanders and senior NCOs to coach, teach, and mentor those units where maybe no one has ever deployed before. Hey, this is how the ops process works. This is how the intel process works. This is how we become efficient at what we're expected to do.
As you looked at trying to assess for the commander whether you were being successful with the mission, whether you were meeting the goals that you'd laid out during the design process, talk about how you used that information collection and sharing in order to inform the commander that you were either on target or that you needed to make adjustments.
Mm-hmm. So assessments are hard. As an MCTP OCT currently, this is something I talk about at all AARs. It's always hard. It's not harder on the border. It's just, what do you measure? And it requires a graduate level analysis, since honestly, some of the information of or intelligence or general awareness just isn't there. We anticipated that fentanyl prices in the United States would be a good measure. That was one of our first measures. Well, fentanyl prices vary from Los Angeles to Brownsville, Texas, and there's no variable you could dial in to say, this is the price of fentanyl. The price of a cartel to move a person across the border was a better measure, and that's something that we could get access to. You know, we had our grand ideas in mission analysis, our initial, you know, when we were there executing first month, and almost none of them turned out to be valid. But as we spent more time talking to Border Patrol, Office of Intelligence, local law enforcement, as they worked with our task force out on the border, we got to have a better idea. And the first part, I think, of assessments is what we were measuring the right thing to measure? We quickly found out that there are some things you just can't measure. Even though there's a dollar amount and a volume amount assigned to them somewhere on the internet, port, an open source report, classified intelligence report, or whatever, just because it's there doesn't mean it's having an effect. And sometimes it just came down to kind of the tacit knowledge of Border Patrol. The Border Patrol agents being on the ground in the spring, experiencing a flood of traffic coming across, and that not happening. But that would take a while to get back to us because it was coming through platoon to company, battalion, brigade, to JTF. I say all that to say it's hard, but you have to be comfortable with the fact that what you're going to measure isn't probably what you need to measure. And I think that's the lesson I learned. Just because we said these were 7 PIR that we started with and they were kind of the genesis of our measures, we had to be comfortable with changing them. Dan Walker, just a super talented ORSA who is doing a lot of really innovative stuff with machine learning, artificial intelligence down there, was pulling us through this as we tried to provide the right feedback to the commander. And we got to the point, and Aaron, this might have been after you left, I don't remember, it was Saturday mornings became...
The cub was
replaced on Saturday mornings by an assessments update, which was a more of a conversational meeting than it was a formal kind of cub what you would be used to. Dan gave his pitch. I think you would go.
I would talk about where I think we were headed, and then an assessment near term and an assessment long term.
And then I would, there was a red intel thing that we could assess, then we would talk about it specifically against a measure. Well, more often than not, we would talk about our organic or allocated assets. Mm-hmm. And and make recommendations based off the assessment from Dan and Aaron on what we were going to do with that item or capability.
Yeah, and when you talk about assessments, there are built-in assessments. But the other piece is the Border Patrol had metrics. So we had the utilizing Maven Smart System. We had the ability to collect a lot of this data. Dan Walker, our OWRS at 10th Mountain, had the ability to analyze this over time, to put in things like fentanyl prices and other key narcotics. We were able to track those. But the CBP had their, Customs and Border Protection, had their own metrics, and they're actually written into code. So they looked at apprehensions, detections, turnbacks, gotaways, and they each have their measures. The key piece when you look at this at a higher level is those are the Customs and Border Protection's metrics. So when it came to reporting those, CBP is the one that needed to report those. Internally, we were able to gather that data. We were able to evaluate that data, see how we could become more efficient. But that's not the U.S. Army data or 10th Mountain Division data that goes up. So making sure, to your point about how do you meld this in with the people you're working with. And Maven Smart System also offered opportunity to really have a functioning COP, where everything from the data we were assessing ourselves down to locations, to what were the new national defense areas, where essentially parts of the southern border became a post. Those were clearly defined on a layer in Maven. That offered a tool for us to do everything from common operations to machine learning, generating set reps, as you mentioned, assessing ourselves.
As you're looking at these parallel channels that are providing information and sharing information and discussing things, can you talk a little bit about how that impacted operations, either from your perspective in terms of what you were implementing or what maybe DHS might have been doing to adjust their activities based on what seems to have become a much more free flow of information between people that may not have been sharing information, not because of desire to not share information, just because they had not been practicing it the way that you have kind of done it as a JTF?
So when you talk about the sharing of information, I think the key piece here is authorities. So there's a long history of U.S. military presence on the southern border. The authorities that were granted down to the JTF for this mission were a lot more than they had been before. So really, when you talk about that coordination, it's, what is the commander authorized to do? And this is everything from arming guidance of what people would have in their weapons to whether or not they, U.S. military members, were allowed to patrol with the Border Patrol, or whether or not there could be temporary detainment of individuals that were apprehended. So when you talk about what's required for that coordination, it's almost a discussion more of authorities that were granted than it is of any particular action. I think at the unit level, and I think you saw this with 112 in your previous interview, having a battalion commander with that level of experience with a CBP, a sector, was really invaluable to that organization to be able to evolve, to be able to see trends, to be able to change patrols. And then at our level, between the ops process and the intel process, we could take what they observed and adjust assets to be able to make those patrols more effective, both in the scheduling, everything from aircraft to ISR to other collection opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, from an intel cycle, still very constrained in some ways. As we talk, what's the difference between awareness and information? And so the operational reporting generated by the maneuver units was extremely valuable for my JTF Southern Border internal process. That enabled me to have awareness conversations with my law enforcement, interagency, and intel community partners. And any feedback they could give us, we would integrate that into our process, whether it be adjustment to the collection plan in support of a maneuver operation, or in support of a maneuver operation that is designed to get after a Border Patrol outcome. And so those were the type of adjustments we were able to do based off of those metrics, and really the metrics drove dialogue.
So far, we've talked a lot about the U.S. side of the border. If you could, a little bit, talk about the trilateral aspect of some of the mill-to-mill relationships where both your forces, DHS forces, and the Mexican military were working together all at the same time, even though you obviously have the dividing line of the border separating your activities.
I was down there from really February to May. We had started to talk with MexMil. There were patrols that were done in conjunction with a U.S. patrol on one side of the border and a MexMil patrol on the other side of the border. A lot of people don't appreciate the fact of there have been eradication efforts from the Mexican military going back to the 70s. So they have their own problems and their own challenges associated with operating so close to the cartels. But they did do everything from land patrols to air patrols in conjunction with U.S. forces. And really, we saw an effect of that, of being able to show that there was coordination occurring between the two, and that really went into the partners.
JTF Southern Border is new. It's a new headquarters. JTF North had had this mission for a while. JTF North had the U.S. Border Patrol coordination cell co-located, and they were capable of doing coordination with Mexmil out of that headquarters through the Border Patrol regional offices. They all have deep, deep roots with Mexmil regions on the other side, and the guys that man the phones are obviously Spanish speakers, but they've talked on the phone with these Mexican military counterparts for decades. And so instead of being top-down driven from the southern border JTF, because we were looking for where is the general officer that General Nauman has conversation with, who is JTF northern border in Mexico? That was the conversation in the early days. The battalion commanders were able to find the foreign coordination cells inside of the regional offices and get after patrolling alongside Mexmil on either side of the border faster than we could have ever facilitated kind of this operational to tactical dialogue with Mexican militaries. Aaron's correct. We had a couple of phone calls. It was rough. Networks, you know, we're going to use our personal cell phones. How are we going to get a hold of these guys? There's operational security concerns. And a couple weeks after he left, I went down to the border to Mexico City with General Nauman, Division Command Sergeant Major Brett Johnson, the G5 lead planner for this, Major Bill Barnan, and one of my 12 Andy Staff Sergeant Rodriguez, to facilitate translation interpretation. And so we went to U.S. Embassy in Mexico City, and we met with every interagency intel community member that is in the country team. They had a special country team meeting for us that gave us great insight. But the most powerful meeting we had is they took us to Defensa. So understanding the Mexican military and its structure is the first part. So Defensa, Army National Guard, National Police, Marina, Navy, Marine Corps, Littorals, etc. It's not like the Department of War. There's no Secretary of War equivalent inside the Mexican government. There are two independent military structures, and their commanding generals are appointed by President Sheinbaum. And there's historical reasons for that. That's not part of this conversation, but you have to understand that the Marina guys are in the water working with NORTHCOM and the two Coast Guard task forces that were out in the water. And then we had to develop a relationship with Defensa, and they're apprehensive. They've got skin in the game. And so we went to Defensa headquarters, and we were welcomed by essentially their version of what would be the DAG-3 and the DAG-5. And so they have their lead operations officer, their lead planner. They have their, what ends up being my counterpart for a little while, but it's the deputy to essentially a Defensa. This long conversation about what JTF Southern Border is, what their northern border mission is. It's got an operational approach and tactical outcome. They showed us where all their infrastructure was on the border. It was a great conversation. It was a great start. The boss, General Nauman, did a really good job of forging a relationship. And then they took us to something that I don't think we were kind of mentally prepared for, but they took us to their counter-narcotics museum. And they walked us through the history of the Mexican military countering narcotics inside of Mexico. And you end the tour with a memorial to all the Mexican military that have been killed in action conducting the counter-narcotics mission. And so that, for us, as the team down there trying to build this relationship, showed you that this is part of the mission. No matter how you view the problem set, you have to be partners. And it really brought us closer to our Mexican military counterparts. And so we finished up our meeting at the embassy, very fruitful event. We flew back to the States. We got to the headquarters, I think, a couple days after that. And so we set up a phone call. And that was the start of a bi-weekly O&I sync. NORTHCOM had delegated foreign disclosure to our headquarters so I could share Secret Rail Mex information with them through a Centrix-like system that they had in their headquarters. So we just started everything that we could foreign disclose to them, we started dropping just to build credibility. And because that was what we were trying to do right off the bat. This is why we're valuable to you. We know you're valuable because you've got skin in the game. You've lost your soldiers and Marines to the cartels. And so we want to be value added to you. And after about 4 weeks of that, they provided their first Rail US document back to us. And that was my second to last day in the job. And, you know, if there's a metric for building a relationship, of intel sharing relationship quickly, I kind of check that one as a win. It's all about relationships and networks and getting outside your comfort zone and absorbing that narrative, because not all of it's good, right? There are parts of the narrative that, as a U.S. serviceman, you kind of balk at. I acknowledge that there's a demand for narcotics in the United States, but that's not the problem we're trying to solve. This is the problem we're trying to solve. So how do we control this as two sets of professional military? And once you come to that place, these trilateral patrols with PFCs from a striker brigade or an MP brigade and PFCs from a National Guard Defense Force are walking down the border together, that's powerful. That's when it becomes powerful.
This idea of being a JTF, it's a completely different environment of bringing the joint force together. And you guys have talked about it a little. You operated in vast areas between official points of entry, planning and conducting maneuver operations, patrols, air transportation, intelligence analysis, monitoring and detection. The list kind of goes on. As you look at the idea of setting the theater, what allowed you to execute this mission as unique as it was?
So when you talk about setting the theater, you look at the roles of responsibility in doctrine and which organizations or which echelons are supposed to take on which, you know, which tasks and responsibilities. So for us as a JTF, even though we were a direct report to NORTHCOM, Army North as the theater army was responsible for setting the theater. So there are a lot of challenges that went on with this. So one of them is RSOI, right? So receiving personnel. They flowed in from really all across the country. Between 2-4, 89th MP had elements from all across the nation, 101st DSB out of Fort Campbell, 3rd Cab coming in as well. We went through an RSOI process that was stood up very quickly. Very important things like staying rules for the use of force or SRUF. You know, there's no ROE because we're inside the continental U.S. They really helped conduct that onboarding. So the other thing is, when you talk about the movement of personnel and equipment, cannot overstate how important this was and how much of a challenge it was. So you don't have a lot of infrastructure on the border in some of these areas. So when you talk about flowing personnel and you're talking about moving thousands of troops, especially when we reset the border, you know, some units went all the way from California, and when we aligned them underneath a chain of command, had to go all the way to Texas. You know, we brought in striker units to Davis-Monthan in Tucson, and then 2-4 road marched from Tucson down to Fort Huachuca. Why? Because there's not a railhead, you know, nearby. So when you look at some of those RSOI and setting the theater requirements, you're really more established in a place like Kuwait than you are in Arizona to bring in these forces. The other thing is basing. So I'd mentioned since the 30s, the Army has been reducing the number of posts. Well, we had a lot of troops that were living in hotels. There's a force protection piece of this. It's harder for them. There's a weapons storage piece. There's an information piece when it comes to the intel systems. So we looked pretty hard at where can we get forces actually onto a base and create living systems for them to be able to not only work, but also to train when they're not on cycle. So there were a lot of standing up of different outposts and other locations that had been active that we switched on to. And again, the threat from the cartels for our soldiers was real. When you talk about everything from the vehicles, you know, we lost 2 Marines when their vehicle rolled over. So just the aspect of moving around and road construction on the border, all the way to where they were living and threats that came from the cartels to our soldiers and Marines that were assigned to us.
The intel oversight, you're talking about RSOI brief, who's your intel oversight officer? How many do you have? You can't do these things, you can do these things. If you want to liaise with local law enforcement, provost marshal, non-35 series, you know, those types of things set the theater. I think the most powerful thing was the operational framework, though. And then Aaron talked about reorganizing the JOA. Just like in the MP, when you allocate force, you know, you do your COFMs analysis, but really this was a terrain analysis problem up front. Sustainment brigade goes to a place because they lack mobility, they're relying on a rental car fleet. Our most maneuverable unit goes to an area which requires the most maneuver capability, strikers in Arizona and New Mexico. And then P brigade ends up in San Diego, a major built up area, which they're in peace, so they're very used to operating inside these cities. That's part of it. But what is the joint operations area? What is the JOA? And that was a dialogue we had to have with NORTHCOM. How far south does the JOA extend? How far into the bodies of water does it extend? That was, I think, some of the most powerful conversations we had. All the things you do with RSOI bring folks in, but what is the operational framework that you're operating within, and how does that facilitate handoff between operations and intelligence and targeting process? It's a major component, I think, often gets overlooked. We get fixated on coming from home station, arriving, getting the brief. Rattlesnakes are dangerous. Make sure you're hydrated in the summer. Move out to your hotel. Cartels are a threat, but this is the area you're operating within, and this is where our authorities lie physically on the ground as we have outlined graphical control measures. That's part of setting the theater. And circling back around to the cartel threat as it being real, how do you create counterintelligence or a supporting force protection model with provost marshal type capability for local law enforcement? But how do you create that framework around something like a bunch of hotels in the Rio Grande? That is a very porous border area that both populations on both sides are intermarried, interrelated, and the source network that is there creates challenges to determine what the threat actually is to the soldier.
So Chad brought up a good point. It's a battlefield framework discussion. In addition to talking with the NORTHCOM commander, you know, their staff had to pivot too from we're used to missile defense, we're used to air intercepts, to hey, we have a land-owning unit. When you establish a battlefield framework, you get all the other coordinations that go along with it. So if I have AOR and within that JTS Southern Border has their AO, well, then I can do things, you know, beyond deep close rear. Well, this is where my intel handover line is. Okay, this is where I can establish NAIs. This is where this target moves off into this area. I need to do an adjacent unit coordination, or I have another asset covered down on it. But if you don't establish the battlefield framework, everything becomes harder because you don't have a mechanism to control what's going on.
As you were receiving forces from across the Army, not just from folks there at Fort Drum, there are a lot of units that are going through transformation and contact. They also just brought different equipment than what you might have seen, like infantry division. With that in mind, what systems worked for you? And then what things did you come away from this saying, we need more help in developing better systems that are going to support us if we're doing this kind of a mission in the future?
Yeah, so that's a great question. There's actually a really long history of innovation on the border. Looking back to 1916, that's where we saw the first use of Army aviation, truck units, fly systems, signal equipment and signal intercepts, and they tested force design on that. You go forward to the Cold War period, first use of dog teams on the border. You go into the Cold War, you see night vision, ground radars, the use of aerostats. The Predator drone was tested on the border before it went to Kosovo. The border offers an opportunity to test new systems for the Army. Within that, some of the things that we saw the JTF was able to employ was counter UAS, something that, especially in 10th Mountain, as we had brigades rotating back from OIR, we had experience with. So we knew that there was a history of what we would need. We were the first unit in the Army to field advanced software upgrades for radars to be able to track small UAS. 2-4 was able to test their MPRCs, so their multi-purpose reconnaissance companies. With a new UAS, they were the first ones to receive the Black Hornet upgrade as well. And what the border offered was an opportunity to test this in a rigorous environment against fighting and an innovative enemy that was trying to protect their bottom line through smuggling. And you didn't have to go OCONUS to see the effects of it. I would take away of what was a technology that was worthwhile on the border is small UAS at the unit level and then counter UAS more and more. The number of drone incursions into the continental United States was something that the first time we got the numbers back, we had to relook them because there were so many incursions into our homeland from UAS, either from cartels or from parties that we didn't even know. Now, this is something we're going to see in the battlefield. It is something that we have to be prepared for. And for the soldiers that test these items, you want to talk about mission buy-in, right? They're out there, they're deployed to the border. It can be a very austere place, but they're out there protecting the homeland. And I know 112 talked about this as well, but they're doing it with the Army's newest equipment. They're employing the tactics and techniques that they were trained on anyway. You know, infantry units doing long-range patrolling. I think there was a high return for the soldiers that were involved with this because the Army staff in particular bent over backwards to get the units down there the latest and greatest material they could.
We were about midway through inactivating our brigade military intelligence companies to stand up the General Support MICO, but we were IOC. We were taking a brand new structure to the border with us to test, and that's in signals collection teams, human collection teams, various other capabilities that we hadn't been fielded, but structurally they were there in force design, and that's what we were testing out. We were developing a lot of requirements for different types of collection equipment or feedback to existing programs of record that are being phased out for future systems on how to better suit down at the border. We were really in a requirements development phase. And so Lieutenant Colonel Will Schwafford, Eagle 2, 101st G2, he's really seeing that now. I was down at the Intel Senior Leaders Transformation Forum about a month ago, and I got a chance to talk to him about it and all the work that my warrant officers and chief warrant officers did on developing requirements for single source collection and then analysis. It is coming together right now for TIC's sake with the IEW Battalion 101st. And so what we saw was testing some new structure with some SIGINT collection teams with legacy collection equipment. We had been fielded a couple of nascent machine learning tools from the Army that are easy to field. Here's a program, and they do these types of functions for us. And so we were definitely in the transformation and contact realm with having the General Support MICO there in this new force design structure and getting it implemented.
Okay. As you look back on your time at JTF Southern Border, what would you highlight as things that you need help from either the Combined Arms Center, COEs, or the joint staff in order to be able to make sure other units are prepared to do this mission in the future or similar missions?
I'd say, first of all, as soon as we got the order to deploy down to the border, CAL sent a huge packet of lessons learned. And then the Army North, a lessons learned team, also sent items down. So from that, we were able to pull a lot of the experiences that occurred on the border. So the authorities change over the time, and we're more permissive now in the authorities than the Army has been probably since the turn of the century. But taking those lessons learned, especially when you talk about some of the things with setting the theater, when you talk about basing, when you talk about movement, when you talk about the austere environments and medical care, those are actually pretty well documented, and you see them coming up over and over again. It's not something that I think necessarily requires investment from the joint force, but it's things that commanders and their staffs can certainly mitigate as a risk through the employment of different units. And I think the other piece is the support we received from Army staff. The G357 really went above and beyond to get us as much as possible down there. So between the knowledge base that occurred from previous lessons to the newest equipment, that kind of helped converge on the border to make us successful.
The joint staff also sent down a training team too with a retired Marine 3-star and his team of like J7 folks. They were extremely helpful to provide insights because it came down in the beginning, it came down later, and then they helped us see ourselves. That was helpful. But to answer the question more directly, I think the Defense Support Civil Authorities doctrine is adequate, except in the things pertaining specifically to set the theater in certain environments. And I just think CAL and CAC and the doctrine writers, how do you incorporate the TTPs, even JTF OIR, the 101st, the library missions we've discussed in our experience, how do you incorporate those maybe as appendixes or case studies into the DISCA doctrine? The DISCA doctrine is there. It's good. It's a framework. We pivoted from it. I made my ace chief go grab a copy of it. And I was, hey, everybody, CW3 and above, read this tonight. And tomorrow we're going to figure out where we fit in. So it's adequate. I just, maybe an appendix or an annex that discusses these three unique case studies, because they're all different. Go do foreign assistance with a disease. Go stop ISIS and then figure out how to control the border. Three unique circumstances. Three different types of deployments, three different types of operating environments. So,
just personal experience being the Brigade 3 for the Mosul counterattack. When it comes to authorities, if you could batch authorities that a commander would need or a commander should look at in a certain event that can be requested at one time, sometimes those take weeks to go through. So if there's a way to call lessons learned on authorities required, both CONUS and OCONUS, there's probably some goodness in that, because there are some that are needed regardless of the mission, particularly when you talk about engagement authorities, when you talk about the ability of soldiers to conduct certain operations. And then again, that can be a weeks or longer process to work its way through sometimes the whole of government.
Based on my experience in 2019, soldiers are static. They're on a hill, they're in a remote viewing station, they're at a camera site. But they can't move. Only the sergeant of the guard can move, and that's for force protection issues. We were having this conversation at Drum, and I forget who said it, and why can't we patrol? And that was one of the first authorities that we asked for when we got on board. And the question was, well, why is that a constraint? Who has the authority to grant that authority? There's no master authorities matrix sitting in D.C. It says we decided they couldn't patrol because of these, you know, political reasons or these federal regulations or these state prohibitions on federal forces inside the territory. You know, and so it's really what kind of questions do you ask to deconstruct what authorities could or couldn't be granted to you? You need to ask for everything and be told no on the things that create risk to the commander. The reason the 10,000 Division was able to get down there and figure it out is because not that we had mastered the basics, but we were rehearsing the basics. So many CPXs. We always joke, when do we get to CPX 2? But we did so many command post exercises. We did a Division Live Fire. We were days out from warfighter. And to rewind this, 99.9% of the staff took over in Romania when we were deployed in support of Atlantic Resolve, where we had a mission. We were doing security cooperation with those in AO Victory South as part of Atlantic Resolve, and we had some federated support to mission partner stuff from an intel side. And so the team had come together during that, and we had figured out how to do that mission, but it was a storming, forming, and norming event. Then Colonel Andy Harris departed. We got Aaron in right as we were starting our CPX progression. So you had an experienced staff, and just not the primaries. You had in the G2 shop, I didn't have much turnover. So I had soldiers that had been doing all these missions deployed already, who went into a large scale train up, and then we were given a mission and we executed. And so I talked to General Nauman about this in my last counseling. The basics are what made us successful, with an eye towards innovation and transformation. We knew we had to be innovative. That's just problem solving.
So instead of a warfighter, we just went into the basement there at Hayes Hall and started planning. It's not something we expected to do, but because we had that foundation, the basics, it's something we could do, and it was something we were able to pivot to accomplish, honestly, relatively easy. And then the methodology, too, going from MDMP to design, back to MDMP to campaigning. Because the staff was proficient in all those processes, although there was the stress of the no-notice deployments, although there was the pressure to get on the border as soon as possible, it was all very achievable because moving through those processes was something that we had already been trained to do.
Gentlemen, I really appreciate your time today. I would like to thank you for all the insights that you've provided to the force. As we step away, I would like to give each of you an opportunity to say anything that you would like to our audience or to the Army about what you learned from this or what you want to take forward into the future.
And thanks, Jeremy, for the opportunity. And thank you for call being able to be a repository of just lessons learned. When you talk about the border mission, they aren't sporadic deployments. They're really episodic. We've seen this happen since the turn of the century. We've seen buildup on the border starting in the 70s all the way to the late 90s. And we've seen brigades on the border starting about 2018 on. This will be a deployment for another unit down the road. So the lessons learned from JTF Southern Border, before us, JTF North, before that, JTF 6. Before that, there were a litany of other organizations. It's valuable to take account of these because the Army will be on the border again. And because of the instability in Mexico, it is our border, and that's what we're required to defend. I do want to take the opportunity to thank all the units down there. I hope the soldiers that served with us on the border saw a purpose in what they did, and they got fulfillment out of knowing that they truly addressed a national security concern. Like I mentioned, we lost a couple of Marines down there, and those attached units were as much part of us in the 10th Mountain as if it had been one of our own brigades or battalions. So they really became part of the Joint Task Force Southern Border team. And I think the dedication of all those units and honestly the majors that I had in the G3 shop / J3 shop were some of the finest people I've ever worked with. And I enjoy keeping in contact with them to this day. The one other thing I'd add as a takeaway is that we shouldn't be taken back when our soldiers do what they're trained to do. So the very first time that JTF Southern Border got the authority to patrol, they encountered smugglers coming across the border. The first time an infantry squad went out along the border, they did exactly what they were trained to do. So when they're given the authorities, they're given the tools, they have the talent to go forth and accomplish the missions we expect them to do. And I think we should all in the Army, and in the nation take comfort in the fact of knowing that our soldiers are well-trained and well-equipped, and when we put them out there, they will accomplish the mission.
What your biggest lesson learned? Be prepared to engage at the highest levels of government. You will, in these scenarios, regardless of the mission, the JTF that's formed will end up engaging in the highest forms of government. We, Aaron and I, briefed the Secretary of War, the Chairman, the Chief Staff of the Army, the Army Secretary, a long list of Congress men and women that came through. So be prepared to speak about the mission intelligently, clearly, and know what requirements you aren't getting met so that you can communicate those clearly to senior leaders. That really was another one of those watershed events where, as General Nauman would say, Mutt and Jeff, the presentation between Aaron and I, we were able to get these senior leaders to understand where the gaps in authorities or resourcing was, and that was extremely powerful. I've alluded to it a couple times, relationships and networks matter. You don't have to like everybody, but you need to treat everybody with a professional respect. There are people that I worked with on the border in 2019 that I ended up engaging with again and when we deployed to establish JTF Southern Border. And so those people remembered the very sizable Major Chad Corbin when he was Roxxon 2, trying to solve the same problem, but in a more constrained environment. And so reestablishing those relationships wasn't hard because I treated them with a professional respect that they remembered. And so for the audience, you cannot like somebody personally and still achieve an end state for the commander and the National Command Authority by treating people for professional trust and respect. And networks. Networks matter. And the basics matter. And basketball, baseball, football, it doesn't matter. So when you come to the Command General Staff College or the career course or warrant officer basic course, study the basics and master the basics with an eye towards innovation and transformation, and you'll be able to pivot to any mission the Army gives you. You just might have to learn some new stuff about an environment that you weren't prepared to learn about. To all the soldiers, Marines, sailors, Coasties who are supporting us for the Southern Border mission, we really appreciate it. And to the Majors and the Chiefs, and Sergeant Major Lundeen, my G2 Sergeant Major, thanks for keeping me sane during those early months. It was a lot of hard work. It was easy because we were trained and ready to execute, but it was a hard easy. And so you had to put a lot of time, energy, and investment to getting the right dialogue and networking going to achieve the effects that you were trying to get after. And so to the Majors and the Sergeant Major and all the Chiefs, thanks for keeping me sane. Especially the Intel Sergeants. They made it happen.
Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us and sharing your insights. Today, we discussed lessons learned from members of the 10th Mountain Division staff during the JTF Southern Border Mission. You can find resources available by going to www.army.mil/call, our CAC-enabled site. There you may also download products or request print products shipped to you. For more insights into the topics discussed today, see Call's Insights from the Fight podcast, Episode 4, The Southern Border Mission, our report on securing the southern border, and the upcoming 10th Mountain Division's Lessons, Reflections, and Observations. Additionally, you can find articles and best practices from units by searching our publication site or our Quickfire site enabled by the Vantage Portal. If you have trouble finding information on our website, use the Request for Information tab and receive direct feedback from an analyst at Call. Finally, if you have a best practice to submit or a capability gap that requires a .mil PF solution, submit observations directly to Call using the Quickfire portal on our website. Be sure to like and subscribe to our podcast and follow us on social media. I would like to thank all our Call team members, and especially the members who collected on the Southern Border Mission led by Major Craig Derenkamp. As always, thanks to Ms. Paige Cox for producing and publishing this podcast. Thank you for listening to the Insights from the Fight podcast. We are dedicated to providing you with the insights you need to lead, train, and fight today and in the future. Join us next time for another discussion on lessons learned from the force.